We'd like to welcome to our campus Dr. Robert Benny. He was born in West Point, Nebraska, educated at Midland College, where he received his bachelor's degree, then at Erlangen University in Germany. He received his master's degree and his PhD from the University of Chicago. He then taught from 1967 to 1982 at the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago as professor of church and society. And from 1982 to the present, he is the Jordan Trexler Professor of Religion, the head of the Department of Religion and Philosophy at Roanoke College in Salem, Virginia. He has served on numerous church committees, lending advice and aid as an ethicist. He has numerous honors and awards, including a Fulbright scholarship to Germany. He has also studied at Hamburg and at Cambridge. Author of numerous books and articles, we welcome him to our campus, Dr. Robert Benny.
Good morning, and it's good to be here to visit the great Midwest. I can't say the snowy Midwest, because where I came from, Virginia, there was much more snow than here. In late October of 1993, the ELCA created even more public furor than did the Missouri Synod in the mid-70s. And both disturbances brought great distress to Lutherans. What brought this anger and distress about? Banner headlines appeared all over the United States in that week in October. Something like this. This is from the Omaha World Herald. Lutheran Task Force supports gay unions. In our valley, the Roanoke paper had Lutherans support masturbation. Variations on that came out on the front pages, not tucked back safely in the religion department, but in the front pages of many, many newspapers. Public embarrassment to millions of Lutherans, particularly since the pastors and congregations had not yet received the statement. The press got it first, and the press did with it what it wanted to before the statements were actually out. This sensational publicity had dramatic effects. 20,000 calls and letters per day swamped the ELCA headquarters for at least a week. And in last week, there were still 50 to 60 letters arriving per day. Pastors and groups and even synods met to demand changes. The Lutheran, our denominational magazine, ran a picture of a sign in front of a Missouri Synod church saying, "We're not those kind of Lutherans." Fairly clever proselytizing. Groups met all over the church to discuss the statement once it came out. A dozen pastors in our Roanoke Valley met to have the statement discussed, and when the word got out, by the time the discussion was held, 120 pastors from the whole synod arrived to discuss the statement. I was a presenter, our bishop was a presenter, and Eric Gritch, who was on the task force of Professor Gettysburg Seminary, were one of the presenters. More dramatically, the project director of the statement was dismissed, not from her job, but from the project. The church council provided a statement about 3 pages long, which promised a new approach with much more elaborate supervision and consultation. It assured the church that a revised statement would be more firmly based on Scripture, the confessions, and the tradition of Lutheran ethics. All sorts of local parishes are having adult forums on the sex statement. I'm conducting one myself at our home parish in Salem, Virginia. And later on this winter, I'm going to do a lay school course entitled, "What You Always Wanted to Know About the ELCA Statement, But Were Too Angry to Ask." So was this explosion caused by sensationalist media coverage? Partly, yes. It took the most controversial elements in the statement and lifted those out. It quoted out of context, And of course, the whole thing hit people before the statement came out, which was a tremendous organizational boo-boo by the ELCA. But partly this great furor is not because of sensational publicity. Partly the great furor is because the statement does, in fact, boldly try to revise Christian ethics at a number of crucial points, though on other points it remains strongly within the tradition. Christianity Today commented on the statement rather positively. It says, how Lutherans justify sex, if sex does needs justification, by saying this, but the news, it comments on the sensational publicity, but it says, the news media missed the real news, that in 1993 a mainline Protestant denomination was releasing a sex statement that used the word sin freely to talk about that which the statement's authors saw falling short of God's ideal for his human creatures, adultery, for example, and promiscuity, pornography, sexual abuse, and prostitution. Also, it based a sex statement largely on scripture and theology rather than social science and pop philosophy. It also thought about sex as much in terms of its relationship to the community as to the individual, and as much in terms of right and wrong as in terms of compassion and caring. The ELCA task force even called on unmarried couples to abstain from sex and not to live together until they could tie the knot. We commend the task force for not concocting some abstract principle such as justice love, as the commission of the Presbyterian Church did several years ago, overhauling Christian sexual ethics. The Lutherans listened instead to scripture and theology. So there are some strong points in the statement. It's 21 pages long. I'm not going to try to go through it with you here. It strongly affirms marriage as the proper place for sexual relations. It argues against premarital sex and against casual cohabitation. It issues a strong critique of the use of sex in our society, in entertainment and advertising. It's very strong against sexual abuse and harassment. And it tries, but I believe not successfully, to operate out of the Lutheran themes of the gospel as the hermeneutical center of scripture and of law and gospel distinctions. These strengths make the statement harder to reject out of hand, like the Presbyterian one was. Nevertheless, the statement, I believe, is grossly and fatally flawed, and I will argue vehemently against it. In fact, I counsel that the bishop of the church should withdraw it to spare the church the kind of alienation of affections that's going to take place as congregations discuss the statement. That probably will not be heeded, but what will happen is a drastically revised statement, I believe, will be shaped out of the new arrangement. It's flawed, above all, because it doesn't directly, systematically, vigorously elaborate a vision of Christian marriage and family life that addresses, I believe, the most fundamental domestic issue in both church and society, that is, the splintering and unraveling of marriage and family life. That is the thing that needs to be addressed in a systematic, exciting, vigorous way. That's the greatest challenge of our time in the church and in society, and the statement simply does not take that task up as its central calling. It's taking up sensational and highly controversial issues, which have to be taken up, should have been taken up as related issues, and the central issue should have been the retrieval and invigoration of the Christian vision of marriage and family life. However, that's a major problem of omission. Let's look at the statement within its own parameters, that is, problems of commission. I list four major objections to the statement, and as I unfold these, I'll tell you something of what the statement's about. This critique will be in Lutheran Forum in the next issue, so you can have a closer look at it if you wish. First, I argue that the statement has within it a distorted notion of the Lutheran idea of the calling. There's a whole section entitled Living Out Our Baptismal Calling, Our Baptismal Vocation as Sexual Beings. Now, I believe that's a fundamental mistake because I don't have a calling as a male. I don't have a calling to realize my nature as a male sexual being, nor do women have a calling to realize their nature as sexual beings. Rather, we have callings to marriage, and we have callings to family life, and within those callings, sexuality is expressed blessedly and hopefully, joyfully. Now, why is it that there's a whole section entitled Our Vocational, Our Baptismal Vocation as Sexual Beings? I believe it has to do with the statement's desire to discuss sexual expression outside of marriage. And that seems to me a legitimate kind of interest, but I would have much preferred to have that section entitled Our Baptismal Calling to Marriage and Family Life and discuss sex as a focus within that, and then pick up related issues having to do with single life, teenagers, the widowed, and gay and lesbian sexuality later on. But they didn't do that. They broadened this notion of calling to include our calling as sexual beings. My hunch, and I elaborate more fully in this critique, is that underlying this is a strong gender feminist and gay ideological concern to make realization of our sexual identity a fundamental interest in Christianity. That is, strong gender feminists, I distinguish gender feminists from equalitarian feminists, gender feminists arguing that there's an essential difference between males and females are ontologically different in a dramatic way from males, and therefore they need to be able to realize their identity in a way that's been suppressed and oppressed throughout the ages. That and the gay argument of sexual confusion and sexual their identities being suppressed by the surrounding culture, there's a powerful need to talk about realizing one's sexual identity, and for many of those people, that is the primary calling in life, is to realize their sexual identity. So I believe the subtext in the document is driven by strong gender feminist and gay liberationist ideologies that skew our calling away from marriage and family life into our calling as sexual beings. It's in this section that one of the notorious paragraphs takes place. That is, they're trying to discuss sexual expression outside of marriage, and it's in that statement that this statement on masturbation appears. Again, they're talking about our realization of our calling as sexual beings, which I strongly disagree with as a way of stating the issue. It says, it's important for children, adolescents, and adults to learn how their bodies are created to be a source of pleasure. Masturbation, a means of self-pleasuring, is generally appropriate and healthy unless it becomes compulsive or hinders development of life-fulfilling relationships. Now, I don't want to send masturbators on great guilt trips as if that were possible in this culture. But it seems to me that masturbation is a lonely, self-absorbed, somewhat pathetic substitution for what sex was intended to be. And that a paragraph like that is strategically stupid and theologically shallow. And as I said, I don't want to go out on any great mission to make masturbators feel guilty, but nevertheless, that is an autoerotic, self-absorbed, short-circuited way of participating in sex. It may be a lesser evil than a lot of other things, but it's not the kind of thing that we should be encouraging. I can get very sarcastic about what you could do with that if it's so healthy and pleasurable. Why not use it in youth groups, things like that, you know, to calm things down. Mm-hmm. And this word self-pleasuring, what a powerful biblical concept, huh? So So anyway, the first objection I have is to this idea that we have special callings as sexual beings. I think that's not biblical and not Lutheran. Secondly, the statement moves toward what Lutherans have often been accused of is Lutheran antinomianism. That is, as we receive the gospel and faith becomes active in love, this love is spontaneously rich and does not need guidance by the law. We are free from the law. And this statement particularly engages that theme, plus uses the theme of eschatology to see eschatology as relativizing all current ethical arrangements. So in both ways, it tends to argue that love cannot be bound by laws, structures, and it avoids completely the order of creation language. So what again is the subtext is to have love break down some of the obstacles, structures, impediments to gay relationships. I think that's the bottom of the line, that order of creation language has said there's a form to creation and love must flow in proper form. That is, we don't allow love between siblings. We don't allow love between consenting adults who are relatives. There's a form to creation that is that love must observe. What the statement has is what moral philosophers call act utilitarianism. You act in the moment without regard to rules or laws or forms to benefit the neighbor. And there's a very strong whiff of that. The neighbor love cannot be defined and overcomes all human structures that have sometimes been set up to oppress and to limit. So again, this antinomian whiff or drift is there, I believe, to break down the notion that there is an order of creation that has to be observed as love is expressed. Thirdly, and this is probably where the most vigorous discussion will go on, is I believe that there is a strongly biased biblical interpretation going on in the statement. The statements, all the biblical statements having to do with homosexuality are addressed, and every one of them is historicized and relativized. That is, what the Bible's really talking about is not homosexuality, but something else. So Sodom becomes gang rape and a violation of Middle Eastern hospitality. And other places are viewed as cultic aberrations or idolatrous practices. Now, Paul's a little bit harder to do that to. So there's a whole section on Romans 1, 26 to 27, but even that is relativized and historicized, that Paul is operating out of a Hellenistic culture that was appalled at the loss of male dominance that was suggested in homosexual relations. And so even Romans 21, 26, and 27 is somewhat historicized or relativized as Paul really not knowing what we know now. And nevertheless, even all these statements notwithstanding, the statement argues that the Bible does not know about homosexuality as a fated condition in which there's no choice involved, and is not addressing the faithful love and committed love between persons who have this fated condition. So therefore, because we know that now about human beings, the Bible didn't know about it, and besides these statements were all addressing something else rather than homosexuality, they were addressing homosexual acts, but those are symptoms of something else. Therefore, these biblical statements cannot be taken as definitive direction for Christian sexual ethics today. Now, after they've discussed neighbor love and kind of pushed order of creation language out of the way, and as they've taken up biblical texts and tended to relativize them and say they're not addressing what we know today about the nature of gay and lesbian relationships and the nature of gay and lesbian people. After this, they say, what does it mean to love the neighbor who is gay or lesbian? And they elaborate three different responses. The first one is the classical Christian response, down through the ages. Abhor the sin, but love the sinner. So gay and lesbian people, if they act out their gay and lesbian orientation, are called to repentance and to abstain or to try to become straight and offered grace. And the blessings and invitation of the Christian community, given a repentant spirit and a change of behavior. So hate the sin and love the sinner is the first response. The second response is a more confusing one. It looks upon homosexual orientation as a disorder of creation, a disordered condition. But it tries to accommodate pastorally to this disordered condition. It says that the Bible and the tradition argue for a heterosexual complementarity between the sexes, and that's God's intent for creation. And homosexuality is imperfect and disordered. However, given the modern world, we know that all people cannot be called celibacy. So we make a kind of a moral calculus, arguing that faithful gay relationships are preferable over promiscuity, and therefore we make an accommodation to gay pairs and couples, supporting them and their relationships and tolerating gay behavior within the Christian community. That's the second middle position. The third position, in terms of loving the neighbor, is full acceptance. That is, the same principle and guidelines that govern heterosexual relationships are to be applied to gay relationships. But you fully accept gay relationships, you bless gay unions, and that would follow from that very clearly that practicing and overt gay people would be in the ordained leadership of the church. That is the third position. Now, where the rubber hits the road and where things really got hot was its statements about, these three different responses. And let me read you what the statement says. It says, all three of these responses are present among the laity and clergy of the ELCA and the theologians. And this is the highly controversial paragraph. Response one, hate the sinner, hate the sin and love the sinner. Response one needs to be questioned on biblical and theological grounds, indeed challenged because of its harmful effect on gay and lesbian people and their families. Responses two and three are strongly supported by responsible biblical interpretation within a Christ-centered Lutheran theological framework as articulated in section one. This crucial time in our church, we need to engage in careful and continuing deliberation regarding the biblical theological bases and the ethical and ecclesial implications of all three responses. Because of the differences present in our church, we are challenged to listen respectfully to the witness of those whose perspectives are different than our own. But in fact, it's ruled out number one as a legitimate biblical and theological interpretation, which is probably held by 80 to 90% of the people in the ELCA and probably the vast majority of biblical scholars and theological ethicists and theologians. So it is it's going to be grilled, and that no doubt will be the subject of the hottest controversy in the ELCA. So from my perspective, that's biased biblical interpretation. They've not even reported the counter-arguments of what I think would be the majority of biblical scholars in the ELCA, not even reported that as a responsible biblical position. My own argument is that it would take an intellectual to miss the heterosexual structure of the Bible. That is, from the beginning to the end, the covenant of God or God's intentions is between a male and a female. And you wouldn't even need particular texts to see that that's what the Bible's all about, and that that is God's intentions for humankind in relationship, in sexual relationship. And the texts, contrary to being all relativized or historicized, are confirmations of that deep, deep structure within the Bible itself. And therefore, a church ceases to be biblical and orthodox if it backs off that fundamental biblical structure. Now, what you do then with the presence of gays is a complex question. In a shorthand argument, I believe we have to be very ethically clear that that is God's intentions, but pastorally sensitive and flexible. I think it is preferable for gays to be in faithful relationships rather than in promiscuous relationships. And I find that I've been in many parishes where there are gay people. I don't know whether they're practicing or not. I am friendly and welcoming to them. And if I were pastor, I would try to find ways to hold up the ethical ideal and teach it to our children and to everybody that will hear and receive it, and at the same time try the best I can to be humanly concerned about people who are struggling with their sexuality. We can come back to that in the question and answer period. The fourth objection I have is that the statement has a biased interpretation of homosexuality. Again, it solves all the interesting issues to debate before it gets to the statement. A lot of the issues are solved before it gets to the statement. The nature of homosexuality is simplified in the statement to suggest that it's primarily biological. There's no choice involved with being gay or lesbian. And for gays and lesbian, this is a natural thing. Now, it seems to me that that's highly controverted and highly controversial, and the literature is just as much on the side of nurture as it is on the side of nature. And most of the statistics that are available suggest that only a small portion, perhaps as small as 1% of the population, is exclusively homosexual. That a much larger group, 3 to 4% of the population, are bisexual. Now, if you've got that kind of bisexuality, it seems to me obvious that you've got choice and volition involved in sexual behavior. It's not a fated kind of thing. And therefore, the statement is dishonest in making it look simply like it's fated and no one can do anything about it. So it doesn't report the debate going on about the nature and provenance of homosexuality. And it does this because it wants to make the case for the church accepting gays. If they can't change, they're fated to be that way, let's accept it and apply general Christian ethical standards to gays as well as straights. Well, that, I'm sorry you haven't read the statement. I'm giving you my critique and telling you something about the statement. But I think in one way, why this sort of thing pops up in the ELCA is more interesting than what pops up. Why does this sort of argument or this sort of statement come out of the ELCA? Now, I suspect that Missouri Synod people might think that there's a loss of theological clarity, biblical authority, and a declining sense of Christian truth in that accommodated mainstream denomination. No, I don't think that's completely true. There are plenty of people with clear Lutheran identity left in the ELCA. Many professors, writers, pastors, bishops, laypersons who think classically about that's the only way you can account for the great outcry. Nothing's ever happened like that in Lutheranism before, that many letters and calls coming into any kind of headquarters. And one of my friends in Church and Society in Chicago told me how impressed he was with the careful, detailed reasoning going on in many of the letters. Some of them are abusive and angry, but most of them are careful, theological, biblical, ethical reflections about this tough topic. So I don't think we've lost it all yet, ladies and gentlemen. But there is a serious problem of authoritative leadership, from the headquarters especially, but also from seminaries and sometimes from synods. Why? At the surface, it's our great desire to be a new church. That's what the ideology and the rhetoric was at merger time. The ELCA is going to be a new church. There was a discomfort with who we are. By the way, the role of the AELC, the Renegades from the Missouri Synod, was very powerful and effective in the merger, tipping things, I believe, in the wrong way. So you're partly to blame for what's happened. There was great discomfort with who we are. We're so disgustingly middle class, 98.5% white, educated, male-led, and worst of all, of Northern European heritage. And you're worse than that. You're mostly Germans. And there was this great desire to be inclusive and diverse. In a book that Edgar Trexler wrote, cleverly entitled The Anatomy of a Merger, he said that these two words, inclusiveness and inclusivity and diversity, were the buzzwords or the God words of the merger negotiation. God words in the sense that it was taboo to ask what they mean or to challenge them in some fashion. They were the hot wire words that guided what was new about the ELCA. And this desire to be inclusive and diverse was embodied into a strategy, an approach, a mechanism that is in fact a deconstructive virus set loose in the church. All the church's organizational life is subverted by this deconstructive virus. Now, if you mean by diversity and inclusiveness, if you mean by that Catholicity and the evangelizing of all sorts and kinds of people, racial and ethnic groups, who would disagree? But that's not what it was about, primarily. Our starts in home missions are down. Our missionaries, to a great degree, have come home, or at least are diminishing. And our minority membership is growing ever so slowly, from 1.5% now to 2%, with grandiose ideas that by the year 2000, we will have 10%. Won't happen. Only 24 of our seminarians are African American, and there are only 10 Hispanics. After all this huffing and puffing, after inclusivity and diversity. No, we haven't meant Catholicity in the classic sense. What we've meant, this mechanism, this deconstructive virus, is a quota system, a set of representational principles that is both formal and informal. Formally, 60% of every organization the ELCA has to be lay, 40% is clergy, 50% of every appointed and elected body must be women, 50% must be men, and 10% of each of these units must be composed of people of color or of whose language is other than that of English. And Slovaks, Hungarians, and Czechs do not count. They're a little bit too came from. But there's an informal quota system which some have branded the hermeneutic of pain. That is, those who say they are victims in any particular issue are ushered right to the center of the discussion and given a privileged voice. So on the sex task force, there are two activist gays on the task force of, I believe, 15, and perhaps 4 or 5 strong gender feminists. So right in the middle of all of our adjudication, you also get this idea that the marginalized And the victims must be the main voices in the discussion. Theologians are one interest group among many that should be there, but primarily it's a different sort of hermeneutic. Well, the deeper question, why? Why this quota system, besides diversity and inclusiveness, which is there? Let me give you two reasons of the deeper question about why. There's the suspicious pessimist version, and I believe this suspicion and pessimism is carried by these strong gender feminists, by gays and liberationists, and particularly now by multiculturalists, who are very strong in the church. And that is, following kind of a Marxist interpretation, that the normative tradition of the church, its ethics, its theology, its practices, are a product of the dominant group, which are male, middle-class, Northern European types, and seriously distorted by the self-interest and the tendencies toward dominance of those groups. So this becomes oppressive to those who are not part of the dominant group, to women, to persons of color, and whose language is other than English. And this dominant tradition, infected by the self-interest of the dominant group, has to be broken up. So how do you break it up? But by establishing a quota system, both formal and informal, that calls into question that which has been said in the normative tradition. So you interrupt it and shake it up by views from below, from the margins, knock out the old boys' network. And the LCA has done a pretty good job of knocking out the old boys' network. That's the suspicious pessimist view of why you have to build in this kind of quota system, both informal and formal. The sunny optimist position is held by Bishop Chilstrom, I believe. That is, there is such an overflow and surplus of true Lutherans that the church will surface them no matter how it chooses them, even with a quota system. Lay, women, gays, Hispanics, men, doesn't make much difference who you select. All can be trusted to bear and promote the Lutheran tradition. I believe that's far, far from the truth. The ELCA, as all religious denominations, all religious traditions, is infected powerfully by religious individualism of a rampant sort. Missouri Synod not being spared that one iota. We're in a market situation now with religious identity, ladies and gentlemen. It's all out there, and people concoct their own. And you give your folks any sort of rundown on orthodox belief, and you will find them all over the map. And that's true, and perhaps even more true in the ELCA. But it would be true in your denomination also. So you have to select the bearers of the tradition very carefully. And in the ELCA now, there are many women theologians who are trustworthy bearers of the Lutheran tradition, but you don't surface those simply by quotas, and by particularly this informal quota system, where those who cry the loudest that they're victims are the ones who are at the center of the conversation. So both rationales for quotas are crazy. They are weakening Lutheran authority in our church, when all churches are already weakened by religious and social confusion among their laity, and it's no time to continue to deconstruct the kind of tradition that we have used to identify ourselves and our mission in the world. However, this debacle, in conclusion, this debacle that has happened to the ELCA could be a great blessing in disguise. Quotas have been under fired from all sorts of directions in the church, all sorts of quarters. And now it seems to me that church authorities are being shown inescapably, that current approaches are leading to chaos in the church and confusion in the church. Leadership must be given back to those who bear the tradition, who know who they are as Lutherans, know the tradition, love the tradition, are willing to converse with the world about the tradition, but believe strongly in it. So this hullabaloo over the sex statement may and well be a great blessing for the ELCA as it grapples with the great struggle of maintaining its Lutheran identity and mission in North America. Thank you very much.
Okay, we have some time, and Dr. Benny will be happy to field questions. So if you will come to the microphone so that others can hear your questions, please.
Thank you for coming, expressing your views on this. I'm Randy Stan. I'm a second-year student here. I'm a Slovak that hopes that my voice will continue to be heard in the Synod. My question is this. If you have such deep-seated reservations about this particular presentation, and would you at some point have to make a moral choice as to your conscience if this position would be accepted? And would you also characterize the chances of this platform being accepted as it is at this point?
I'll address the latter first. I don't think there's much chance of this statement being accepted in its present form and its present direction, even its present direction. And my prediction, I'll tell you a little bit more about what the Church Council did. It said there must be a oversight group of 11 people that will work with the task force. It did not dismiss the task force. I would think if I were on the task force, I'd think twice about remaining on it. It dismissed the project director, but the task force is there. I suspect there will be some resignations on the task force. But the task force is officially intact. There'll be 11 people, three appointed by the bishops, three theologians from the seminaries, a couple of lay people, and I forget what the other ones are. And this group of 11 will oversee the work of the task force. Now, who's going to do the drafting? They're going to hire three people on a part-time basis, theologians from I don't know where. My friend in Church and Society suggested humorously that I might be one, and that is humorous, and those three will do the drafting. Okay, so you've got a whole new ball game with three drafters, the same task force, and an oversight of 11. Now, when do you think a state will emerge, given those sorts of dynamics? My prediction is that in 2002, we might have a statement before the ELCA Churchwide Assembly. So it's going to be a long process, and that's why I wanted the statement withdrawn, because the only statement that's going to be before us for a long while is this statement, and I think people are going to be very upset by that, pretty upset by that at least. So that's my answer to the first one. The second one, the role of church statements in the ELCA are not to bind one's conscience. That is, they're meant as deliberative documents to try to state the mind of the church, but those who dissent have the freedom of conscience to dissent. So there will be I've dissented from many, many of the statements formally and openly, and I certainly don't consider them to bind my conscience. Sometimes these sorts of things are kind of the last straw for people, and they leave for other religious traditions. And that happened with Richard Neuhaus. Went from the frying pan to the fire, to the fire, I think. But people consider that sort of a lot of ELCA congregations will probably leave the ELCA. In fact, are in the process of doing that now. Not a huge number, but a number of them, and many congregations are escrowing their money, their benevolence money, in protest of this. So, you know, nothing works like the withholding of money, and the Church Council took a very, very sober response to this whole thing, and so I think it's going to be a long, drawn-out process and will turn out to be different than the present direction.
Sir, I am Charles Philip Schaum. I am a second-year student here, and I've been in dialogue, at sometimes heated, more or less, with a number of ELCA people, including several ELCA pastors, over Jeannie's electronic medium for the past few weeks. If I may, I would like to read two very short statements regarding agenda and this issue. One pastor, Noah Vail, writes to another pastor, Kevin Guiri from New Orleans, "Be sure you preview the study tape before you show it to your members. Make sure it's the impression you want to give of the ELCA as it was produced prior to the church council's actions. For example, the only discussion about the draft in the tape consists of an interview with a Lutheran gay man and a Lutheran lesbian woman. Sigh, it's been quite obvious towards which direction the draft was tilted, but the tape makes it obvious as to what the task force wanted us to discuss." Regarding some more items about an agenda, Guiri then comes back with notes on exegesis and agenda. "The historical critical method, unlike the historical grammatical, rightly admits that we cannot dissociate ourselves from the existential matrix that constitutes the thoroughness of our very being. That is, we cannot either as individuals or as churches approach scripture as though with a tabula rasa. We must of necessity bring to this divine human encounter our histories, experiences, passions, etc., etc., etc." He calls this a heuristic medium through which we will view the text. He says, "There is a punctuated moment of grace when one approaches scripture from a position of faith, a general possibility of having one's life broken open by an act of God as one encounters his word within an existential framework of faith and community." It seems that there are several agendas being followed here, certainly not least amongst the exegetical aspects. Do you have any further comments on that?
Well, I think I already told you in my presentation that I believe there was a powerful agenda working in the task force. And if you look at the bottom line is trying to overcome the classical strictures against homosexuality or to overcome the classical Christian insistence on the heterosexual nature of the covenant between man and woman, if you look that that's what the primary purpose of the task force was, then a lot of things fall into place. I tried to argue that a lot of things fall into place if you see that as the underlying agenda. So I do agree with that, and in fact the editor of the Lutheran said so publicly in the denominational magazine. So that kind of language is very present in the ELCA. The quote you gave sounds like a lot of existentialist gobbledygook, and I hope that doesn't represent a responsible theological opinion in the ELCA. One of the major things that's happened in response to this statement is a statement that began at Luther Northwestern Seminary, which reaffirms classic Lutheran teaching on sexual ethics, and particularly biblical exegesis of a more conservative and classical sort. That statement has been brought out and has over 1,000 signatures to it, and these are primarily professors and clergy. So I do not think that the vast majority of biblical scholars and theologians of the ELCA agree with the direction that the statement took. Now, the whole question of historical, critical, biblical interpretation is a tough one in this regard. I think it can be used to delegitimate the biblical message, but it doesn't have to be used that way. If it's used on behalf of the church and theology, that it has a legitimate role.
Dr. Benny, my name is David Rittock. I'm a second-year seminarian, and I am German and Slovak, one of the worst combinations. The question I have is, if this statement is adopted in whatever form, will it be intended as a guiding principles document, or is there a chance that it could become doctrine? And was it the committee's intention to purport to speak for Lutherans in general, or was that the media's response to the statement?
Oh, it certainly wasn't intended to speak for Lutherans in general. I do not think it will emerge in its present form. What was the first part of your question? Oh, well, There are two things that church statements do in the ELCA. They're teaching documents to try to teach the church, but they're also practice documents in that they set the practice of the ELCA, that is, the internal practice of the church and the way it faces the public world. So a statement on sexual ethics or sex would also be the instrument by which people in advocacy positions in the government in Washington or in various state houses would advocate for certain kinds of legislation. Now, there's a part of the document that I didn't even touch, and these are practical applications kinds of things. Legislation on behalf of families, legislation against sexual harassment and abuse, things like that. So if this were voted in its present form, it would become that sort of practice statement too, shaping the internal practice of the ELCA, but also the way it faces the public world. But as I said before, I think this is many years off, that this is not going to emerge for a long, long time.
Dr. Benny, my name is Steve Farmer. I'm a fourth-year student. You mentioned in your discussion your rejection of the statement's suggestion of a person's baptismal call to their to realizing their sexual identity and so mm-hmm. forth, and rather your suggestion of our baptismal call to marriage and family. How do you address, or how are we as pastors to address people who do not have that call, single people, widowed people, gay and lesbian people, and how are they to find things that we do find in marriage and family, relationship, even intimacy?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good question. There's no question about that there is sexual expression, and we don't become non-sexual beings if we're not married. We're sexual beings, certainly outside of marriage. And the statement does a relatively good job of addressing those sorts of concerns. Teenagers, widowed, widowers, gay and lesbian, I disagree with how it addresses that, but it certainly addresses that. Single people, and has a very nice section on singleness as a possible Christian way of life. It's hard to deny, since Jesus and Paul were single. And it has a nice affirmation of the calling to be single, and criticizes the general societal notion that without genital sexual expression that you're somehow an impoverished human being. So it has a nice polemic against that notion, and does affirm singleness as a real Christian calling, and handles sex outside of marriage rather well. One place where it gets into trouble is that it does not insist on public vows connected with sexual relations. That's why in my introduction I said it denounces or criticizes casual cohabitation. But when it discusses cohabiting, there's a curious paragraph where it says, in cases where public vows may not be possible, then the church may have to arrange other sorts of accommodation. And what I think it's talking about there, given the subtext and agenda, is since the state does not recognize yet homosexual unions, the church should find some way of recognizing that. But at the same time, then it opens the door for private vows between lovers, heterosexual lovers, as somehow being legitimate. It talks about binding commitments, but it doesn't talk about public binding commitments. And I think that's one of the other weaknesses of the argument, that I believe that public binding commitments are what constitute marriage, and that sexuality is most appropriately within that public binding commitment.
Ha ha.
Who's got seniority?
Professor, you said that statement's probably not going to come out until sometime in the year 2000 or so. But I submit that the homosexual conflict going on about whether a gay and lesbian should be allowed to be ordained, should be allowed marriage, I submit that that's not going to last until then. The problem is going to have to resolve itself sometime before then. Do you agree with that? Do you think that there is going to be some resolution to that? Do you think that the ALC is going to move towards ordaining gay and lesbian pastors? And do you feel, if not, then what is going to be preventing that move from going on, seeing how it seems to be the shift as of now?
No, I don't think the LCA will move in that direction. What will happen is that the current practices of the church, which are inherited from the ALC and the LCA, which are what I call the classical Christian formulation of it, will be in place throughout this long, drawn-out discussion until there's a new statement. And the bishops, the vast majority of bishops, are for maintaining those classical practices. So at the last assembly of bishops, they overwhelmingly, I think without dissent, argued against blessing gay unions. And they're not even close to talking about allowing overt and practicing gays in ordained positions. Now, what I think is going to happen in this big hullabaloo and this attack on quotas is that more formal authority is going to move toward the bishops. Right now, the bishops have a great deal of informal authority. But the Constitution was arranged in such a way, one could say demonically arranged, so that the bishops had no say in the church, or very little say, but they have an enormous clout. They have an enormous informal authority. And so they are taking an active role much more than they were in setting their own agenda and commenting upon what happens at the headquarters and what comes out of the ELCA. The task forces of the church or the headquarters of the church at its peril goes against the informal authority of the bishops. So I foresee a strong shift of authority in the ELCA toward the bishops. Some I could be accused of a hopeful illusion there, but I think that in effect has already happened informally. And so I don't see the practice is changing. Now, there will be a lot of renegade blessing of unions and maybe even some more ordinations, but those will not be recognized officially by the ELCA, and I do not see that change occurring for a long, long time. I don't see it ever occurring, but at the same time, the problem will not go away. The gays and lesbians are well organized in the ELCA and have a good deal of support among some pastors and professors, and there's a fairly strong network in the ELCA, and they will continue to press the conversation forward. So there are not going to be quiet times ahead. It's going to be a long, persisting conversation on these issues. I believe that we have to pastorally accommodate in creative ways with gay people. I didn't want to punish and be punitive toward gays, particularly gays who are homosexual in orientation. And we all know that in the history of the church, a lot of gay people have been celibate clergy and have given their lives to the mission of the church. And I want to honor that, and I don't want to be gay bashing in any fashion. And I do believe that I would prefer and counsel and support faithful relationships over against promiscuity. And how you would do that, I think, would be, I call it in my book, gentle hypocrisy. That you affirm the ideal of the church, and you teach that ideal, and you don't allow that ideal to be challenged. But at the same time, pastorally, you try to make some moral calculus that some things are preferable to others. and you try to work it out that way. I guess sometimes I thank God in the morning that I'm not a parish pastor and have to deal with some of these sticky issues.
Gary Shopper, staff member, Dr. Benny. I wanted to ask for your opinion on, it seems to me that when we talk about the gay community or gays and lesbians, we're always saying, what are we going to do with them?
Mm-hmm.
And when we talk in those terms, it seems to me that we are talking about gay and lesbian concepts as a set identity. And when you talked before, you talked that maybe there's more fluidity there than we are willing to accept, both as an American society and sometimes as church people. Would you speak to the fluidity and the concept that perhaps gay and lesbian concepts should be talked about as behavioral systems and not specifically as identities?
Sophisticated question. I don't know how you can completely separate identity and behavior. You weren't suggesting that, were you? Or just treating that as overt behavior? Is that the question? I mean, I fully agree with you
yes.
that there's a continuum of
yes.
identity.
Yes, there seems to be a continuum yeah. of identity. And also, Scripture, it seems, does not label gay or lesbian, but it talks about behavior.
That's the statement's argument, yes.
So it seems to me that as Christians, and when we approach this concept, that we should approach it from a behavioral point of view
uh-huh.
And then see where that leads from that point of view rather than approaching it as an identity and then talking about behavior.
This is the Clinton approach to gays in the military, right? You constrict and restrict behavior, but you don't talk about identity. Don't tell, don't ask, but don't behave. Well, that would be an interesting way of handling it, wouldn't it? Just proscribing certain kinds of behavior, just as that would fall into the argument of the statement that gays ought to be guided by the same principles that that straights are, right? That outside of marriage, there is no genital sexual expression. That's a behavior. But gays, I think, would argue that they're in a catch-22 because the church nor the state allows them marriage, so they can't behave as they wish to behave. They can't express their sexuality. What you say has a certain amount of persuasiveness to it, and maybe in fact that's the way we ought to go. Forget about this debate about identity. Might be a possible out. Is that what you think?
Yes, it seems to me that approaching it from a behavioral point of view is the scriptural way of going at the concept and then dealing it from then and how it produces identity. But then we have to talk in those terms also
mm-hmm.
rather than doing it the other way, which our society seems to want us to do today.
Ah. And certainly the statement tends to do it in that way, realizing our sexual identity, our identity as sexual beings. And so you're moving it over to a behavioral thing. Interesting. We'll put you on the task force.
Thank you very much, Dr. Benny, for being with us today.